Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight we will go time, the seasons pass, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score that would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History and its Memorabilia on the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network, in conjunction with Slick Enterprises. We're live from the Wallingford, Connecticut home of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'm Bob Slick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 140-plus years of football history and memorabilia, and you can find us on the web at GridironGreatsMagazine.com. We're sponsored in part by MSB Sports Cards. Check out their website for the best selection of football cards and memorabilia at MSBSportsCards.com. And we're also sponsored by BST Auctions. Check out their website and their upcoming auction this fall at BSTAuctions.com. It is at this time I would like to introduce my co-host, who is a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also in Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Larkin. He hails from Portland, Oregon. I'd like to welcome to the show Joe Squire. Joe, welcome to the show this evening.
Good evening to you, Captain. How are you, sir?
I'm very good, Joe. I'm very good. We got a bit of summer back, nice warm day here in Connecticut, and it looks like a beautiful evening coming up, and we're doing what we love doing, talking about football history and memorabilia on the Gridiron Greats.
I got it.
Publishing and broadcasting.
I got to say, Captain, every time you do your football, I can't even do it justice, but every time you do it, if you can imagine me just smiling, a Cheshire Cat grin, and shaking my head, just laughing. I absolutely love it.
I've had several of our listeners say that's one of their favorite parts of the show, and how I can keep that going as long as I can amazes me also.
Yeah.
At the same time,
I think we could. I think we could make some money turning that into a ringtone.
That'd be helpful. That'd be helpful. But on a more serious note. And I know all our listeners and friends and family have been following two devastating hurricanes, Harvey that ripped into Houston, Texas, and parts of Louisiana, and then Hurricane Irma, which basically damaged several of my beloved Caribbean islands. Those people know me know Brenda and I love vacationing in the Caribbean. Two of our most favorite islands are the Turks and Caicos Islands and Anguilla. Mm-hmm. Both damaged very, very severely. A lot of people asked us where we were going in January. I said, I have a fully booked vacation to Anguilla, and we're uncertain what's going to happen, because when you go to Anguilla, if you fly out of JFK in New York, you're flying into St. Martin, and then you either take a boat or you take a little prop plane from St. Martin to Anguilla. So obviously St. Martin's airport is down for, I don't know how long it'll be down for, so we're going to play it by ear. But we're trying to get into tonight's show, as you and I both briefly talked about during the week. What happens when there's a natural disaster, such as a hurricane, a tornado, and collections are lost forever? And we're both curious to really find out, and we won't find out for quite a while, how many collections have been damaged or ruined from these hurricanes? Joe, I'll hand it off to you.
Yeah, and obviously I'm an electrical contractor, and we do a lot of work for insurance companies. So probably 3-4 times a week I'm in somebody's home that has been damaged, you know, by fire or flood, you know, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm constantly seeing, you know, the damage around that. One time in the, you know, 15 or so years I've been doing insurance work, have I come across a sports card collection laying out in the yard, half burned. And it was, oddly enough, a 1984 Topps football set. You know, and I knelt to the ground and cried a little tear for seeing my 1984 Steve Largent card number 196 laying there. But I've also been called probably 3 times over the years as a consultant for, hey, somebody said their sports card collection was damaged and they want $100,000 for it. Can you help? So I've been a paid consultant three times by people to help them value a collection. But I don't know, what reminded me of this, Connor Lambadella wrote an article probably about, 8-9 years ago, and he talked about the paper drives, of the wars vacuuming up scrap paper, including cards. That always piqued my interest, you know?
Well, I've always maintained that, I know we talked about this on the podcast over the years, with the paper drives, with all the, natural disasters that took place right up to World War II, think about how many football programs, Street and Smith's football, Illustrated Annuals of Football, football programs, ticket stubs, cards, were just gone. And I've always maintained, and I think it finally got a little traction over the past 5 years, that people finally started saying, hey, you're right, there isn't a lot of stuff 1945, from 1869 to 1945, in the area of football.
Totally.
I don't care what anybody says. You could go to any show you want, and I do prove it from the National this past year. There wasn't a lot of stuff that was pre-World War II there. Because of that, I really believe that area of collecting, to me, has so much more value, so much more historical value. But really,
very rare.
How many are still there? I mean, realistically, how many 35 National
first of all,
sets?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Take a program or a ticket stub from, let's take a Red Grange, because I'm trying to put together a program and a ticket stub for every game Red Grange played in college. All right, I just set it on air. That's my BHAG for my collection.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so, first of all, how many people went to the game? Let's say it was a popular game and 40,000 people went to the game.
Mm-hmm.
How many people saved their ticket or their program versus throwing it in the trash? So take a game from 1920, people saved the ticket or threw it away. How many people came home and put the ticket in a safe spot? And over the next 90 years, how many grandkids or children didn't accidentally throw it out because dad, kept it in the book that, they donated to the library?
Right.
How many floods
and fires
have taken some cards? I mean, first of all, people threw them out, and then they've been lost to just, people throwing them out on accident or, being handed down, and then floods and fires. And you just wonder, every year, the odds of a 90-year-old piece of paper making it another year, get smaller and smaller.
Right. And I really believe very strongly that the whole market for pre-World War II items in football, both college and professional, is very, very undervalued based upon what is actually still in existence today. And to me,
absolutely,
I don't care if you have a fair to good 1935 Chickel set, or you have a near mint PSA whatever, 8 or 9 set, it's rare.
Yep.
I don't care what anybody says. I don't care if you have a bunch of college programs from the 20s along with ticket stubs, they're rare. And again, when I was in collecting more active collecting Yale football programs, I had a bunch of 1920 programs. And I'm going back to the early 1990s now. And I had several collectors who wanted a couple of my programs, and I offered them to them. They did not like the price I was offering because I was basically as they told me, you know, you got prices of the future. I said, yeah, but how many are still in existence today? And what I sold them back in the early 90s for was cheap compared to what you could try to find them today for. You know, literally double, you know, double and triple the price type of situation. So realistically, all that memorabilia, and you know it quite well with your Grange collection, I feel is very undervalued, to say the least. And it should not surprise anybody to pay a substantial amount of money for a program or a ticket stub. You know, whatever
obviously,
it may be. Even if it's... Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, and obviously the East Coast is where, you know, the majority of this stuff is. You know, nobody was writing, you know, T206 cards. You know, Portland, if a house in Portland was built in 1908, that's old. You know, I've mentioned before, nobody was hiding T206 cards, you know, in the walls, you know, of a house being built in Portland. But on the East Coast, you've got houses built, you know, with old horsehair, lath, and plaster. You know, there's old stuff in you know, in East Coast, you know, collections and houses and basements and stuff. You know, so much more susceptible to loss. I mean, have you ever lost part of your collection to water damage or fire?
Oh, yes. Yeah, two separate occasions. Actually, I lost some at this house because I had my man cave and my office is downstairs. Unfortunately, outside is an outdoor faucet. And the faucet had been leaking for a couple of years, and I didn't really think anything of it other than it was a washer. So we changed the washer a few times. So me being the home handyman I am, I power washed the back deck, and I ran the power washer through the faucet. I come inside, and I literally had a heart attack because the whole rug is filled with water, and it cut through where the water faucet was. The pipe actually burst into part of my Green Bay Packer program collection. I didn't lose anything that was overly rare. There was only a couple of programs from the 60s that got ruined. The majority were from the 70s and 80s, but still, I lost about 50 programs out of that flood, and I lost a big box of one of those 5,000-count boxes of newer football cards, so it was no big deal. They weren't rare in any way, shape, or form. My other house, I had a bad flood, and I lost a bunch of 1950s programs over there. That one really hurt. That was a major loss over there. But in any event, you know,
ditto.
I pick up the pieces and I move on, type of thing.
Yeah,
but,
and ditto, even I had something. I had something happen.
Wow.
I said ditto, even I had something happen. I had a gutter spout, you know, that I have pushed away from my driveway, and one of my kids removed it, and so water was just flowing down the foundation on the outside, and eventually it wicked into my man cave. And I came downstairs, and I have a large collection of uncut sheets, and I smelled something in the room, and I noticed some black mold over there. It doesn't take long, about a week. And I pulled some programs out. I could see mold or some uncut sheets out, and I could see mold streaking up them. So, I mean, you know, I'm rolling them out in the basement, trying to clean them, and, you know, and I have some PSA boxes with my cards, you know, with my cards in them, and some of those had mold on the backs. I mean, I'm down there vacuuming up, getting a HEPA filter, cleaning up. So I lost a couple uncut sheets. Luckily, it was, you know, like 1974, you know, were the ones that were damaged. But you know, I had a couple like 1984 sheets where I was like, oh my gosh. But you know, I mean, it happens. You know.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah.
And that's what I'm
curious about is, you know, how many collections were lost in Irma and Harvey.
Right.
Nobody knows.
Right. And. Again, that's why I think a great learning lesson from these hurricanes are make sure that your man cave, your collection area is weatherproof. Make sure you don't have anything on the floor. Make sure, you know, if you have something truly valuable, make sure it is in a, you know, a very safe location. We have a rare program or whatever. Make sure it's on a high shelf. Make sure it's properly covered, you know, with a good plastic covering or whatever the case, you know, whatever you're using for it, so an archival type, so on and so forth. And I think that's a good lesson for everybody to learn from this. As far as my collection is concerned, I have a lot of bookshelves where I keep all my binders of cards, and I got probably about 300 hardcover books, and I got a ton of media guides, so on and so forth. But I would never think where I have storage space in these little, like, cubbies there that the water would actually come through them. And that's what I just found devastating to me, which I thought I was taking the right precautions, and I ended up, you know, ruining a bunch of programs. And again, there was nothing overly valuable, you know, that was ruined.
But it could have been.
Just a point that, yeah, exactly.
But it could have
exactly.
been.
My,
yeah.
My older programs and older yearbooks are stored safely. I've always stored them in a separate location and kept them more weatherproofed and temperature-proofed at the same time. So it's a strong lesson for everybody to learn. It's sad, and I'm waiting to hear, because we have a bunch of subscribers both in Texas and in Florida. I talked to Harv Aronson over the actually yesterday I talked to him, and he said he was very fortunate. He lives in Jacksonville, and he said there was just some flooding. He wasn't impacted in any way, shape, or form, so that worked out good. But I know I have a few people down Miami, Dade County area, Naples area, who subscribe, and I haven't heard anything from them. So hopefully they're okay and their collections are okay at the same time. It's a lesson to be learned, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And it's
those hard covers, you know, the program,
right,
the program top loaders are really helpful.
Right.
You know, because I had some programs, I had some uncut sheets in those uncut sheet top loaders that was on the ground. So, I mean, you know, those didn't get damaged by the same moisture that ruined a 1974, you know, rolled up sheet I had. So,
right.
You know,
and I recommend, I mean, for any program collection, utilize the hardcover, not the generic plastic, or not even the 8.5 by 11 Ultra Pro one pocket sheet, which I know a lot of programs can fit in. Make sure, especially anything, in my opinion, 1969 and back, put it in those hard cases. It's well worth the price of getting them. You can, you know, they're not that expensive. You can buy them in bulk on eBay or Amazon, and they're well worth it. Well worth it.
Well, you just saved me a bunch of money, because there are no Seattle Seahawk programs pre-1969. So,
true. But you have your Red Grange program, which is incredibly valuable, in my opinion, with a lot of one-on-ones. So you got to really take care of that, those stubs and those programs. You should be sleeping with them under your pillow at night, type of thing.
We'll see.
So,
I was mentioning to you before the show, I picked up kind of a white whale of an item from my Grange collection. I found a past Gridiron Great contributor and a guest had a ticket stub on eBay that I took offline with him and purchased. I'm very, very happy. So
That's great. I'm very happy for you, because I know you've been looking for that ticket for a long, long time. And that, to me, is very rare. I don't know what anybody says. That's a rare of a ticket stub, if there ever was one. So that's a great pickup, Joe. And I want to know what your next elusive pickup will be. And what you will find in the near future.
Well, I'm sure you're the same way, Captain. But half of the stuff that I want, I don't know I want it until it pops up. And then you're like, oh, that's interesting. Four or five years ago. Yeah. 4 or 5 years ago, I was collecting, you know, sets. And then, you know, suddenly, you know, Andy Becker is showing me, you know, programs and ticket stubs. I'm like, oh, those are fascinating. You know, and then I, you know, I kind of did a pivot and, you know, I'm in my collection. So, you know.
To me, the history of a program or a ticket stub is priceless. It's well worth the investment, just from a historical perspective, to have a program or have a ticket stub from a game from many, many years ago. It's a great feeling, to say the least. All right, we're going to move along, because our guest is ready, and I'd like to introduce him to our listening audience. Our guest tonight was born in Madison, Wisconsin, and he's a lifelong Green Bay Packers fan. He's a graduate of Southern Illinois University, and he's lived in Marion, Illinois for the past 55 years. He's a retired information technology administrator from John A. Logan College, and his current occupation is a grandpa, and he feels it's a great job. He is an expert on the 1962 Post Serial Football Card Set. And I urge everyone who is listening to check out his website on postserialfootball.com. I'd like to welcome to our show this evening Mr. Robin Falls. Robin, welcome to the show this evening.
Thank you, Bob. Joe, how are you guys tonight?
We're good.
Excellent.
We're good. We're good.
Good.
I got to ask you to start off. How the heck did you become a collector of the 1962 Post serial football cards?
Well, like everybody else, I started when I was a kid. The first Post serial cards I got, I was 6 years old. We lived in Paxton, Illinois, and I don't know how we got started. I had an older brother, and we started getting some Tops, some Fleers, and some Post football cards that fall. And I'd take them and I'd line them up on the floor in the hall and arrange them however I wanted. And, you know, that was my thing. Of course, 6 years old, that's what you do.
Wow.
I love the Post serial cards. You know, they had the most color, you know, and they had those neat pictures on them that some people thought they were hokey, but I thought they were great. You know, the guys with they call them posed action. The photographer actually called them the old Huck and Buck, but that's what that's what they were, and I thought they were fantastic. You know, so those really caught my interest back then. There was a guy that was not in the set, was Ron Kramer. And for whatever reason, I don't know if his name was because it was Ron that was close to Robin or whatever it was, but I really wanted to be Ron Kramer, not just, you know, watch him play or anything like that. I wanted to be him.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, that wasn't possible. So the next best thing I could do is I could make my own Post serial football card. So I took a piece of paper and I drew a line down the middle, you know, where the photograph went, and I colored in his picture, and then I cut something out of the paper and put it on the right side and pasted it on top of a Joe Schmidt 62 Tops.
I love that. Absolutely love it.
That's incredible. Yeah, Joe and I were talking about this before the show. I had a handful of 62 Post serial football and baseball cards when I was a kid. I don't remember them that much because I was 4 years old in 62. I do remember more the Salada tea coins because my mom and dad drank a lot of tea. So I would get those coins and play with them, yada, yada, yada. And then fast forward many years later, Kellogg's had those football cards in the 70 and 71 cereal boxes. So I would bug my mother to buy more cereal so I could get more cards out of them. And she was very steadfast. She would buy the two boxes, and that was it. So it was many years later I completed all those sets. But that's amazing to be that little at that time and to actually have that kind of recollection to play when we were playing with them and wanting to be that player. That's just great. That's amazing.
Interesting.
Well,
by the way, Bob, sorry, Rob.
No, go ahead.
Now I was just going to ask a question. I noticed something. This is the second week in a row, or second show in a row that we've had rabid Packer fans on as guests. And I'm trying to figure out where Bob is meeting all these Packer fans. And trying to figure out when the last time we had a Seahawk fan on. Anyways,
did we ever have a Seahawk fan?
Blaisdell. Probably Mike Blaisdell would be the closest. Mike Blaisdell would be the closest.
Yeah.
But
that's true.
All these Packer fans running in the same circles.
I can tell you about Packers fans. Packers are really America's team. That's why you run into them everywhere.
Let's move on to the next question. I'm still singing from that Seahawk loss on Sunday.
Well, that's right.
The talents of the Seattle Seahawks were not on display on Sunday, that's for sure. Website, Robin. Your website's amazing. I was looking at it earlier in the week and then, you know, before the show. Absolutely love your segue from, you know, the 1958, you know, greatest game ever played, and then you move right into 62 poster. It's like, the greatest game ever played. Speaking of greatest game, let's talk about the greatest set ever. I absolutely loved it. So your website, how'd you, how, how and when did you decide to start a website for your beloved 62 set?
That's
quite a commitment.
I got started, you know, like everybody else, as a kid, you quit collecting, and then you start again at some point. And I started doing baseball around 79 or 80 and did that for 20 years. And then I had a chance to sell some cards and make some money off of them from another collector. And I did that, and in doing so, I was introduced to eBay, and, well, you know, there's everything on eBay. And I thought of a couple of cards that I messed up when I was a kid, the Paul Horning and the Bart Starr post-serial cards. I put them on a plaque, glued them on, regretted it, took them off later as an adult, then they looked horrible. And so I decided, someday I'm going to replace those. And so I did, and I found them on eBay, and that got me. I got the Horning first, then I got the Starr, and I noticed that Starr's card was different than the one I had. It had yellow pants, and it didn't look like the same picture. And it's like, wait a minute, aren't they all the same? You know, there's only 200 cards.
That is interesting.
Then I figured out that it had to have come from a different box and that they were printing on more than one box. Then I got a panel off of eBay. And then Kirk Robinson, I think you guys are familiar with Kirk.
Yep. Very good friend. Yep.
He was selling off his panels at the time that I was just getting into it. And I was fortunate enough to get several from him. I'll tell you a quick story. It's, you know, kind of sidetracked. But the first panel I bought from him was one of the more rare Grape Nuts Flake 16-ounce panels with Joe Krakowski on it. He's up there in the guides as a high-dollar card. And so I get it from him in the mail, and I look at it. And you know how those cards are sometimes. They're just absolutely horribly out of registration. And this is just the worst I'd ever seen. And I emailed him back, and I said, I'm sorry. You know, here I am, a newbie, and I know he's like the king of panels. And I said, I'm sorry, but, man, that was a lot of money. Can I send it back? And you could just read in the email. It's like, okay. The nice guy that he is, he says, yeah, I'll take it back. And I ended up getting a lot more from him. So it worked out both ways. But anyway.
Curtis told us privately one of his biggest regrets was, you know, starting to sell that, you know, post-serial set.
And, yeah, he's told me that several times over the years, and we've tried to get him back into it, you know. I've done what I can to help him a little bit, and he's worked at it hard to, and he's gotten quite a few back, so it's a good thing for him.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the cards are different, and, you know, and I noticed that the key to understanding the whole set was the panels. And so the more panels I could get, the more pictures I could get, the more information I could put together, I could figure out how many cards there were of different variations of everything. And so that's what I was working on. 2006, I was selling a card on eBay, and I got a question from a potential buyer. The guy's name is David Charles. And since he and I have gone back for years and years and years, back and forth for years on post-serial football stuff, but he asked me how come there was a line on the right side of a Zeke Batkowski card. And I told him, well, it's because that's where the fold line was at the edge of the box. And it clicked with him. It's like, here we go. And ever since then, we've been just trading information like crazy. And he's really interested in, he does what he calls an extended set, which are players that never made the post-serial 200-card cut, but, you know, were in the NFL in 61 and 62. And so he creates those, he prints them, he sells them sometimes on eBay. It's a really neat set if you've ever seen them. I don't know if you have or not, but if you look every 3 or 4 months, he'll be selling some on eBay. He's up to like 200 extra cards now. So anyway,
yeah,
I've
seen some of his work. It's very nice, and they're very. Again, how many players didn't have a card, and how many players got a card who never played it down in either the NFL or the AFL?
Yeah.
You know, that type of situation.
And he's got a lot of neat bios with him, a lot of neat stories, you know, on guys that, you know, still have interesting things. And, you know, a lot of collectors are interested in that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah, very, very much.
Yeah.
Robin, do you have a favorite card or advertising piece or box from that set?
Yeah. There's a lot of neat stuff there, you know, and a lot of it I don't have and I would like to have, but I do have some pieces. There's proof photos, there's grocery store display pieces.
Oh, wow, that's cool.
Yeah. I think Kurt just came up with the best one. It's a centerpiece that was supposed to be used as the main attraction in the grocery stores, and on the top are three oversized cards of Unitas Horning and Bill Kilmer, and that's
oh,
a
wow.
really neat piece. There are only that I know of, two of them in existence. There may be more, but those are the only ones I know of. There were a lot of things with the set. In the stores, you could get little booklets that were advertising all of the different products that went along with the General Foods promotion, you know, folks being part of it. But there was also Tang and Swan's Down Cake and Gravy Train Dog Food. And these little booklets, there were four of them with Horning, Arnett, Huff, and Sonny Jurgensen. And you could get those on the way out of the store if you asked for them. If you bought a certain amount and you asked for them, they'd give you the booklet. So those are a little bit rare, but you can find them every once in a while. There's action toys that came in Rice Crinkles boxes. And of course,
action
boxes. Action toys, a passer and a kicker. And it had a little rubber band
no
on the back. Yeah, it had a little rubber band on the back, and you'd cock it so that either the leg or the arm, and you'd put a little football with a little hole in the back, and football fit on the peg for a hand or a toe, and then you would get it cocked, and you'd flip a little button at the bottom, a little lever, and the football would go flying.
That I've never seen. That I had no idea.
Wow.
You know, so many of these sets, I'd be willing to bet, the modern-day collector knows more about this set than the person who made it back in 1962. Because at some point, you know, the cereal company had somebody who was in charge of this. And I'd be willing to bet there's stuff that they had no idea about. Like, if you showed them variations, like, well, this is the Yellow Pants variation, they'd be like, oh, I guess the printer screwed that up. You know, it's like the 48 Leaf set. We know all the variations because we obsess about it, and I'm pretty sure the printer back then would be like, oh, I guess the printer made a mistake. You know, they would just have no idea.
Yeah, and with this set, you kind of get the same thing. You get them on different boxes, and so every time they did a different box, they did a different set of rotogravure plates. And so,
uh-huh.
in essence, every time you do that, they're going to be different. So
yep.
you get that. But then you also get a lot of times where the ink colors that they put in, you know, the CYMK that they put in to print the boxes with wouldn't always be the exact same color. And so you'd get different
yeah.
variations. The grass will be darker or lighter. The buildings, you know, will be different. The sky will be different and so on. But
well, you know,
I can see
very clearly the difference of the player cards based on the different cereal boxes themselves just because of the printing and the inks on the boxes. And something I want you to talk about, we'll talk about it in the next couple of questions, the amount of variations, when you listed how many variations there were, I was just shocked to realize, you know, my set is complete at 200 cards, but you stated there's 548 cards in a master set of the 62 post serial. Of these cards, I was just blown away. There's 348 variations. That's incredible. That is incredible.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Well, and the reason is to get the 200 cards, you have to have at least 49 boxes to get those. But that didn't fill out the whole number that they wanted to promote in the stores. And so there's 101 different possible boxes you could get, including little individual alphabets boxes.
Wow.
And when you get all done with the dull prints and everything, you end up with 548.
Wow.
And it is a large number. Yeah.
That's a master set. That's a heck of a master set. I love it. I love a collector who immerses themselves into a set, or just something like that. I mean, because it is a knowledge, just a wealth of knowledge. And I wish there was somewhere that you could go to a central. I mean, like, have you written a Gridiron Great article about this? I don't remember seeing this. Or is it coming up, Robin?
No, actually, we're gonna have it in the next issue. We did an interview, and we're going to have a lot of this information in for our readers. Yeah, man, it's incredible.
Awesome.
I tell you, I know less now than I knew before about the 62 post serial set after, looking at the website and reading your responses to in the interview. It's amazing to me. Amazing. Truly amazing.
Nice. Well, Robin, we always like to ask people about crazy stories, for collecting. I mean, we've heard people talk about meeting people in dark parking lots, the Walgreens, or, chasing Steve Largent down down an airport gangway, to get an autograph. Actually, that was me. Never mind. Do you have any? What's one of your more memorable collecting stories about this set in the quest for the master set?
Well, one of the things that's on the website is I've got a section on there, a photographer section, about who shot the pictures and how I came to the conclusion that it was Jim Lawhead from Dallas, Texas. He and his son-in-law, Brad Bradley, shot the photos. In fact, I think you did, Bob, an article in the SCD in 1990.
About
the Salada coins.
Yeah.
And you named Jim Lawhead at the time as the guy that sold the pictures to the Salada people. And that helped me make a stronger conclusion that it was Jim Lawhead. Through the story, I went through a lot of people to find this out. Dan Mabee, who wrote some baseball post-serial books, Vern Beaver, who was the Packers photographer, George Izzo, mm-hmm. who was quarterback with the Redskins, Bob Lilly's wife answered an email. I talked to Brad Bradley, the son-in-law of Jim Lawhead, who worked with him, for 30 years or so before Mr. Lawhead passed away. A couple, three times, and I got off on a tangent because he told me one time, he said, well, I don't know that we ever did post-serial photos, but the reality I came to figure out later was they were shooting 100,000 pictures a year. How's he going to know where they all go? These guys were on the road, and there's a fantastic story from the website, if you want to link to it, in Sports Illustrated. The name of it is Mad Hatter in Photoland. It's written by a guy named Bud Schrake, and it's from 64. It's a great story, and it tells about how these guys traveled all over the country, and they would literally drive all night and shoot all day and drive all night and shoot all day, and they did that for months at a time, and all the places they went and what they did and what kind of life they had. But, wow. When I got all done, all of the circumstantial evidence says that there isn't any other conclusion that it was Jim Lawhead who shot the pictures. I'm still looking for hard evidence, I would like to find the originals. There are proof photos, but you've got to tie them back to the source, and I haven't been able to do that yet.
Mm-hmm.
Still working on that. And that's a lot of fun. So I've had a ton of fun with that side of it, looking for the guy that shot the Huck and Buck pictures.
play.
Wow.
That's pretty advanced, trying to look for the guy who shot the pictures. I think it's Kirk, isn't it? Correct me if I'm wrong, Bob, but Fleer set. Kirk has actually identified what game most of the pictures of the 61 Fleer set were
right.
taking. Like, all right,
right.
here's Charles Bednarik's picture, obviously taken at Franklin Field. You know, they played at Franklin Field on these days, but we think that, he's narrowed it down to which game most of these pictures were taken on, which is pretty advanced. I love that.
Yeah, his information on that is just amazing. But again, you know, when you're looking at those pictures in the 62 post serial set, I would assume, and correct me if I'm wrong, they were either training camp pictures and or they were taken after a practice. I would assume, I don't know.
Yeah, there were eight teams that trained in the Midwest, and they were all training camp.
Okay.
Two on the West Coast, the Rams and the 49ers, and they were also training camp. And then the mm-hmm. four teams in the East, the Giants, the Eagles, Redskins, and Colts, they were all taken probably either right before or just after the season started, and they were all taken in their stadiums.
Okay, all right. So that's good information to know because, again, looking at those shots, they were different shots than, like you said earlier, than what was known at that time. They were really classic poses for those players, and you got to actually see the entire player, which was nice.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was a plus with those cards. And again, I looked at them during the week before the show, and they're classic 1960s football cards. I mean, they're just beautiful poses, beautiful teams, classic players, so on and so forth. It's amazing. Robin, do you have a current want list? And if so, what are you actually looking for? Do you have any white whales that you need to pick up?
This should be good.
Well, you guys, one of the items that I was going to talk about on my favorite things out of the set is a Great Nuts Flakes box that has the two most rare cards in the set on it, Sam Baker and Dave Baker. And I detail it on the website, but basically Post set up their own numbering system for how they were going to put the cards in order up to 200, and then they kind of tweaked and manipulated a little bit because both Sam Baker and Dave Baker had issues. Dave Baker was going into the Army right before Post was going to production with these cards, and they had to move him around a little bit because they really didn't know what was going to happen with him, whether they're going to keep him or anything else. This is just my conclusion that I came to. But so they put Sam and Dave on the same panel, a Great Nuts Flakes box. And so these guys, that's the least produced box in the set. These guys end up being the most rare cards, Dave Baker being more rare than Sam's because his other card was on an Oak Flakes box. And it didn't sell tremendously well either, I don't think. Being a small size, folks like the larger sizes a little better, I think. But anyway, those two guys are together. I got that box a few years ago, and that is my favorite item in the set because, to me, that's the signature piece in the set because those are the cards, and those are the two hardest cards to get, and there they are together. Anyway, I've been trying to put together an autograph set, which, you know, a lot of these guys started, you know, Willie Gallimore died in 64.
An autograph, wow.
And Gene Lipscomb wasn't far behind him. You know, some of these guys died early and their cards are kind of hard to get. Well, Dave Baker would be my white whale. He died in 92, I think, but he only played uh-huh. 3 years in the NFL because he went into the Army, and when he came back out, he went to a Christian university in Oklahoma and became the athletic director and coach, and he stayed there the rest of his life.
Huh.
And so the guy probably would have been a Hall of Famer. He had like 25 interceptions in his first 3 years in the NFL, but, you know, nobody's ever heard of him.
All right.
But anyway,
right.
His card is so rare, and it is the most expensive card in the set. I would like to see if there is even one that he signed anywhere. And if I could own it, so much the better. But,
why is his so rare again, Robin?
Why are his so high? He is on the two most rare serials in the set.
Like what kind of population are we talking? How many cards? How many examples?
Over a 10-year period, and I'll tell you, I did not collect every single item over 10 years, but out of 10,000 cards, there probably were 35 Dave Bakers out of the 10,000.
Wow.
And the thing that you got to remember here is there were some that were probably around that, but the thing with him is every time somebody gets one, they sell it because it sells for so much. So you actually see more than in relation to how many there probably are. It's probably close to a one-for-one. If the collector, doesn't have any set and somebody else finds it, as soon as they find it and they realize it's worth that much, they sell it. So you see more than you probably would other guys.
Huh. Yeah, well, that got me. I guess. So, Robin, any advice for a football collector who'd like to immerse himself in the 62 Bo serial set? What kind of advice would you give him?
Well, we talked about the master set a while ago. And, if you're doing the 200, you're going to end up buying some lots probably. And when you do, you're going to get some extra cards. And if you look at them, you're probably going to realize that, hey, I've got two different Bart Starrs, or I've got two different J.C. Carolines, or you know what I mean? And after you get your 200 and you look at them and you figure out, I've got 100 extra cards here that are different, you might want to think about working on what I call a base master set of 412, which is everything except for the double-printed cards. There were like four serials of different sizes that they printed exactly the same as another serial. For instance, the small Great Nuts Flakes box were printed exactly the same by top three boxes. 36 cards, 6 cards per box, and it's the exact same panel on the back of both boxes. So, and if you want to do the double prints, then you get up to 548. So,
all right, but let's re-explain that so our audience understands it. The 412 are the single prints with all the various boxes.
The
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
548 is everything. It's a double print.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the 412 would be easier than the 548 simply because those last 136 cards of the double prints, most of them are really, really difficult to find.
Okay. And those are on the more obscure serial sets, serial boxes and the like, and sizes also.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Robin, if you and Kirk played in a game of 1962 post-serial Jeopardy, who would win?
Well, I think 10 years ago he'd have whipped me good. I'd give him a pretty good run for his money today, I think.
All right. Just hearing you rattle those numbers off, I'm like, oh my gosh. There's probably like four sets that I think I know a lot about. But even every one of my favorite sets, I can think of somebody who knows more about it than I do, and it's not even close. So, you know.
Well, I'll just say that I've had so much fun that it's not been worth. It's just, you know how it is when you get into something and you get to collecting, and, every time you find one more nugget of information, it's just like gold.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
And you live for those. And you live for those. I mean, I do a weekly search on eBay for Steve Largent, and there's times where I've missed, searching for it, And then I live in constant fear that the one really, really rare 1976 oddball, you know, issue from Franz Bakery or something that no one's ever heard of comes up that one time, and I'm not looking. But I still look every damn week.
Yeah, and I can't tell you how many times somebody has said, did you see this? And I didn't. And it's like, oh, are you kidding? I missed
yeah.
it.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's amazing. It's amazing to me because, like I said, I thought I knew a little bit about the 62 post serial set, but obviously the information going through it, it was me. It was like Christmas Day all over again, you know, just reading the website and seeing all the stuff. And,
yeah.
I knew, you know, that I've seen display boxes over the years. I've seen the smaller boxes over the years, so on and so forth. I just really never put it into perspective like you've done that. There's all these different boxes, all these different serials, all these different variations, and it is a collecting journey of a lifetime that you could spend just collecting 62
yep.
post serial. It's truly amazing to me. It really, excuse me, it makes my 200 card set seem meager, you know, among it all. And now I'm got to go through every card to see if I actually got a rare variation card or whatever, you know, type of thing, which I doubt seriously I do. But, my duplicates, too, I got to go through.
Yeah, I'll bet you do. And, you know, you just looked at it and you didn't think of it that way. But since you're thinking of it that way, I'll bet you do have some.
Yeah. It's amazing. And it's the same thing with the 62 Salada set. There's several variations on that. And that I always thought was interesting also, even though I don't have those variations. I just got the base set, and that's it. Wow. Well, Robin, I don't know what else to say, but thank you. This was incredible. And I want to also state it was a great interview that you completed for me with some great pictures, which will be in the fall issue of Gridiron Greats magazine in a few, and actually will be out middle of October. But this is going to be a first, in my opinion, for a lot of people to realize what is actually out there on 62 Post Serial, because it is probably going to be the most comprehensive article in its history talking about the 62 Post Serial. So it's going to be great. I truly appreciate your time and effort with it, and thanks for preserving it, because it is something truly amazing, to say the least.
Yeah.
So, Robin, thank you so much for being on the show this evening, and we will be in touch, and check your email, because I got a couple of side questions for you that I'll be sending out tomorrow. With regards to this. Very good. Robin Paul,
all right.
1962 Post Serial Football Expert. On the podcast.
Thank you, Robin.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much,
sir,
for having me on. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, we're tying. Time's running out, and we're going to go to our goal line stance now. Joe, I'm going to hand off to you. What did we learn on tonight's show?
That was impressive. I'm jealous of someone who can immerse themselves into a set like that. You know, the 84 top set comes to mind. That's one of the first sets I really started collecting as a kid. I wrote an article about it in Gridiron. I forget when it was, 25. Let's see, it would have been 2004? No.
Yeah.
Was it?
Yeah,
2004 on the 25th. 2009 on the 20, yeah, or whatever, some anniversary. And even then, when I was writing the article, I was discovering stuff about the set I didn't know. You know, the 48 Leaf set, when I wrote that, you know, trimmed and doctored article, I mean, there's people, Scott Alpaz, one of those guys who knows more about this set than I do, you know, and I reached out to him for a couple things. Mike Taverner knew more about the printing of it than I do. I mean, there's not one set that I know that I would say I am the expert on, and it's not even close. You know, I mean, yeah.
Well,
I'm impressed.
To me, I've always stated I'm a generalist. I don't feel I have an expertise in any area of memorabilia because I've seen it, a lot of it, I know a little bit about all the different areas, helmets, footballs, uniforms, photographs, publications. If you want to say anything I know a little more about than other people's, probably publications, because that's my first love. And, you know, football cards in general from 48 to 88. I thought, like I said, I thought I knew a little about the 62 Salada set and the 62 Post set. 62 Post, I like I said, I know 10% of what was going on in that set and all the different variations as compared to what I learned over the past couple of weeks. It's just truly amazing to me. Truly amazing. And again, it's the nice part of our hobby when we share knowledge, we share information, so that the true collectors out there who want to collect something, for example, let's say there's a Green Bay Packer team set collector, and he starts out putting together that 62 Post Packer set. Now he realizes there's more than just a handful of cards there. Now he's got the variations. Now he's got the cards on the boxes. Now he's got a lot of different other things he can look for, which really adds, you know, to his collection and adds to his knowledge of early 1960s Packer Glory year football cards.
And there's a website for him to go when he realizes where the hell's Ron Kramer, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And to me, that's the beauty of the hobby, and that's the beauty of trying to share this knowledge. And I do remember many years ago when I first started writing for SCD, Sports Collectors Digest, back in the late 80s, early 90s, I was always asked, well, what's your specialty? What's your specialty? I said, okay, well, I know some about oddball football cards, and I also know a lot about publications. So I still remember the editor at the time said to me, all right, you're going to write a column on publications and just keep writing about oddball football card sets. And as I started writing more and more about oddball football card sets, I started learning a lot more. I thought I knew something about them. I knew diddly squat after I did the article, because I'm saying to myself, I can't believe all the information I found for it, so on and so forth. And the two examples I used, the one example I used in particular was a 62 Salada article I wrote, which people still use as a reference to this day, which I'm just shocked by because there's really not a lot of information about it. And, it's a source to go by. And it, same thing, 62 Post. Now we have a great handle on what's going on with 62 Post.
Yeah.
So that any collector has got to be very, very comfortable in collecting it, you know. So that's
totally
true. That's great.
Cool.
All right, a couple more things before we wrap it up tonight. Again, we've been sponsored by MSB Sports Cards. Check out their website, msbsportscards.com, and also by BST Auctions. Check out their website for the upcoming fall auction.
Yeah. And by the way, let me interject real quick. Hey, BST guys, I keep getting emails from you announcing it. When's the preview coming? And by the way, can a couple people in the hobby, like, you know, the captain and I, can we get a sneak peek here? Andy, John, help a brother out, guys. Come on. Let's get a peek.
It will be coming out, I'm sure, very, very quickly, because there's going to be some incredible stuff in that fall collection, especially from Mike's collection. It's amazing.
Well, Bob, a man of your stature, the ambassador, you know, of football, the captain, you know, at least you should, you know, have a preview. I mean, I can understand why a lump like me doesn't, but I mean, you, of all people.
Well, I take a number like everybody else. I don't like playing favorites. I play by the rules, Joe. You know that. I play by the rules. If the official throws the flag, I accept it. I'm not in anybody's face, nor do I do any. I don't do any dances after a touchdown either. I gave the ball to the ref. And
give
I
the ball to the ref.
Them.
Act like you've been there before. Well, I'm just going to throw it out there. If you guys want some opinions on some quick picks. The captain's a man of honor. I, Joe Squires, will take a look. So,
all right, we're down to 10 seconds. I'd like to thank everybody for listening. We got another show coming up next week with author Chris Willis, who was on our show about 5 years ago. He's got a great new book that came out on the Orang Indians and Jim Thorpe. It's an excellent book, great read, and we're going to talk to
our friend
from NFL Films, Chris Willis. That's it for tonight. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in about a week.
ba 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 ba